to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 27th of June 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week and we are here today to discuss the previous week's news of interest to British people, particularly British nationalists. We have lots of interesting stuff to get into today and of course we also have our Greatest Britain section at the end, and as always, I am joined by my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. What's it like where you are? It's a little bit mizzly where I am. How are you doing anyway?
Oh, the weather's fine. I always like the weather, whatever the weather is, but it's dry but slightly overcast, but still quite warm, and so it's nice weather actually, and as a keen motorcyclist, this is the best weather to go motorcycling in, because it's dry and reasonably warm, but not so hot that you end up sweating to death in your thick leather suit that you have to wear for motorcycling for safety purposes. So, yeah, it's okay.
And, of course, if you have a motorcycle, you don't have to worry about the railways. So the railways are on strike. They're causing all sorts of problems. The guy that's actually representing them seems to be doing quite well, but I think the general public are not very happy. I've heard things being shouted at the strikers by people going past, people that are being held up from going to work, and you've got people that are saying, well, these railway drivers, they're on £50,000 a year anyway. But then you've got other people that are saying, well, there are other people that work on the railways and they're just on the minimum wage there. We've got inflation, which is hitting 10%. So if you've got pay rises being offered of 1 or 2%, it's not even going to keep up with inflation. Then on top of that, we have the barristers, which are going to go on strike, which is, I believe, the first time that this has ever happened. And now we have threats of teachers going on strike, doctors going on strike, postal workers going on strike. We've got news headlines that are likening it to the 70s. And I don't really remember what happened then too well, but apparently it was very bad. Literally, bodies were piling up because they couldn't go to the crematorium. The streets were full of rubbish. At least we don't have the rubbish workers talking about going on strike. I think we do have council workers talking about this. And on top of this, we've just had two by-elections, Honiton and Tiverton, I believe, and Wakefield, very, very, very big Tory strongholds. And the Conservative Party have just lost there. It seems there's lots of upheaval in the air. What do you make of this, Max? Are we in for a summer of discontent? And what is it that has caused this, do you think?
I think we are in for a fair bit of discontent this summer. And the issue with the railways and the other unions that they're putting in for large pay increases, which ostensibly it appears to be quite justifiable thing in view of the fact that inflation is running at 10%. If people don't have a 10% pay rise, then it means that they become 10% poorer if they have a zero pay rise. And over the last probably two decades, perhaps even three decades, it's been noticeable that pay packets have not been going up as fast as prices, and so therefore lots of people are finding that their career earnings have plateaued out much earlier than they otherwise would have liked. But the point is that the pay requests that are being made by the unions are actually being fueled by the fact that inflation is now running at close to 10%. So why is inflation suddenly running at close to 10%? Because people say, well, it's pay rises that drives inflation. But the inflation's been running ahead of the pay rises. So, you know, the pay rises at the moment are lagging behind inflation. So inflation isn't being caused by pay rises. It might be exacerbated in certain circumstances by pay rises, but it's not actually the cause. It's not being caused by pay rises. Something else is causing the inflation. And if you study economics to any extent, what you'll come to realize is that in an economy, there will be a certain value of goods and services that are available to be purchased, and there'll be a certain amount of money within the economy that chases after those goods and services and tries to purchase them on behalf of the people that own the money. And the point is that if you increase the amount of money within an economy, disproportionately to the to any increase in the supply of goods and services, then what happens is that because there's more money chasing a relatively smaller amount of goods and services, it causes the price of those goods and services to go up. So it's an increase in the money supply without there being a commensurate increase in the value of the goods and services available in our economy. That's what's causing the inflation. And you have to say, well, how did that happen? When did that happen? Well, that happened at the beginning of the pandemic. What we had happening during the pandemic is the government deciding that instead of isolating those people that have got the disease and allowing everybody else to continue to work, what they decided to do was to make all the people who haven't got the disease stay at home and do nothing whilst they were paid furlough. And so so because people were staying at home and not going to work, it meant that the volume of goods and services available to be purchased in the economy at best stayed the same, but probably actually decreased during that period, whereas the amount of money in the economy mushroomed because the government were borrowing loads of money to pump it into the economy in order to pay the furlough. And right at the very beginning of the pandemic, I wrote an article on the Western Spring website pointing out the fact that what the government were doing in order to combat the pandemic was going to result in massive inflation. And that's exactly what we've got. We've got the inflation that's been created by the government's mishandling of the pandemic. The government handled the pandemic in quite a good way, in the sense that their rollout of the vaccine was faster than other governments. But they've shot themselves in the foot by paying people to stay at home when they shouldn't have done that. And if you compare the British economy with the Swedish economy, the Swedes didn't have the lockdown, or if they did lockdown, it was only to a minor degree, nothing like the level of lockdown that we had and the furloughing that we had in this country. And countries that didn't lock down, countries that didn't pay furlough, other countries that have got their inflation under control, and that's why but we didn't do that, and that's why we've got the problem.
And of course, they don't want to admit that, do they? These troubles in Ukraine have come along at a very fortunate time, really, for the government, because then they can blame all of this on Putin, and they can say, oh no, it's because Putin is putting the price up on gas and oil, and we have to support Ukraine. But of course, then all you have to do is look at the countries which haven't condemned Russia, India, China. They're all doing very well, and they're all purchasing their gas and their oil at normal prices. And the ruble is at the highest rate that it's ever been. But they're still blaming Ukraine for this. Perhaps this had something to do with the Tories losing. Also, Boris Johnson maybe having these parties when everybody else was told that they weren't allowed to go to these parties. Although I do think the mainstream media is making too much of that. They're still going on about it. Keir Starmer was also caught out having a beer after work with his workmates. It's really not the end of the world. And of course, they make this big fuss about the fact that Boris Johnson was fined. Well, it's the equivalent of a parking fine, isn't it? It's not really that serious, but it does look as if we could have trouble this summer with lots of people striking. None of this, I think, people really foresaw. But you're saying you did, really, Max. I mean, when you saw this furlough that was being spent, and I can remember you saying at the time that this is all going to have to be paid for. One thing that does get me is that 50% of the price that we actually pay for our fuel, it goes in tax to the government. So we're now paying almost £2 a litre for our petrol, and a pound of that is going to the government. I mean, surely they could lower the amount that they're getting from that, because when they put that in place, it was probably about £1.40. So they were getting 60 pence or 70 pence each time somebody fueled up. And now they're getting a pound every time somebody fuels up. So surely they could cut back a little bit on the tax that they're putting on the fuel, but they haven't. So yeah, well, we'll just have to wait and see what happens there. You were telling me, Max, it's also the anniversary of the Falklands War this week.
That's right. It has received a certain amount of publicity, but not as much as I think it is due, and that's really because the sort of liberal left media are a little bit embarrassed about the fact that we actually won a war quite so recently, even though it is actually 40 years ago. And so they don't like to sort of talk about that. Plus also the fact that the liberal left consider that our occupation of the Falkland Islands is colonialism, and so therefore that shouldn't be allowed, despite the fact that the occupation of Argentina by predominantly people of Spanish descent also is colonialism as well, isn't it? So it's a really a matter of, you know, choose the colonizer of your preference, and I think that the people of the Falkland Islands, who are overwhelmingly of British descent, choose to, if they're going to have a colonial government overseeing their country or protecting their country or whatever, however you look at it, then they would choose to have the British government doing it. But the I noticed on iPlayer that there is a program which is called Our Falklands War, a Frontline Story. And out of interest, I had a watch of this, and it's quite rare now that I find a BBC program that I can say is that I can endorse wholeheartedly. But what I would say is that the program that's currently viewable on iPlayer is such a program. It tells the story of 10 soldiers who fought alongside each other throughout the Falklands War, and it's a really heartwarming program in terms of these soldiers really kind of spill their heart out to you as to, you know, how they felt when they were first sent off to war, what the experience of war was like for them, etc., and the problems that they've suffered as a result of the war. There are certain sort of very interesting aspects of the Falklands War which are worth looking at, because I think that the Falklands War gave Britain a great boost in the arm at the time when it happened, because we were affronted by the Argentinian government, who had invaded the Falkland Islands. And we declared our intention to send a task force down to the South Atlantic in order to take the islands back. Lots of military pundits, etc., said that it was an almost impossible task taking back the Falklands, and they gave us less than a 1% chance of being able to take the islands back. But against all those odds, and against the odds from the point of view of aircraft, availability of ships, etc., we were outgunned by the resources that were available to the Argentinians. We still prevailed, and I think that was a magnificent achievement and an assertion of democracy, because, you know, we're not the colonizers of the Falkland Islands. We may have gained sovereignty of the Falkland Islands through the colonial process, but the fact of the matter is the islands were uninhabited before British settlers settled there, and the islands have been settled by British people, and who want to remain part of Britain, and so it is only right that we retain control of those islands. The things that I think are very remarkable are, first of all, the ratio of British troops involved versus the Argentinian troops defending the islands. And this has references back to the situation in Russia and Ukraine. And when the war in Russia and Ukraine started, I said that a fatal mistake that Putin has made is that he hasn't amassed sufficient troops to be able to take and hold Ukraine. I pointed out that the border between Ukraine and Russia and Belarusia was about 1,500 miles, and this compared with the 800 miles or so border that there was, or front line that there was, between the Soviet Union and the German army during the Second World War. And on both sides, and on the German side during the Second World War, for that sort of 800-mile front line, they had 5 million men. The Russians had something like 10 million men. And yet for a border which is twice the border that existed, twice the front line that existed during the Second World War, the Russians only committed something like 200,000 men versus the 200,000 men that the Ukrainians have been able to muster to fight them. And so what's happened is that they're in a situation of stalemate, because militarily, any general, any book you care to read about military tactics, that will tell you that in order to have an odds-on chance of capturing a piece of land, your army has to be 2 to 3 times the size of the enemy's army. And what happened with the Falklands War is that the Argentinians had committed 13,000 soldiers to the defence of the islands, and we eventually managed to transport down there and land by various means onto the islands a total of around about 25,000 men. So it was roughly 2 to 1. And that was the reason why, with our more experienced soldiers as well, we were able to take those islands as quickly as we could. And so if we sort of compare that principle with the situation in Russia and Ukraine, what we can see is that both sides have become pretty much bogged down in a war where nobody's really gaining very quickly over the other side, and it is just a kind of a war of attrition. But going back to the Falklands, one of the things that was mentioned, which was a magnificent achievement on the part of the British Air Force. One of the things that needed to be done early on in the Falklands War was to disable the landing strip, the main runway at Stanley, which is the capital of the Falkland Islands. And we didn't have we'd got aircraft carriers that were traveling south, but those aircraft carriers wouldn't have carried bombs heavy enough to cause the sort of damage that needed to be done to the airfield. But we did have a small number of Vulcan bombers, which were bombers that were commissioned, can you believe it, in 1956. That was when they were designed and commissioned. But these bombers, which are sort of really almost like antique bombers, even at that particular point in time, they were massive, magnificent aircraft, actually. If anybody gets the chance to go to Duxford and see, I think they've got one remaining Vulcan bomber there. I don't know that it still flies, but I went to Duxford and I was able to see the Vulcan flying, and it's an awesome thing to see that aircraft in flight. But we had 10 Vulcan bombers, which were then stationed on Ascension Island, which is in the middle of the Atlantic, which is 4,000 miles away from the Falkland Islands, but also about another 4,000 miles away from Britain. We had a number of Victor air refueling aircraft there. And the Vulcan bombers flew from Ascension Island to the Falkland Islands, having to be refueled 3 times on each flight. And even some of the Victor bombers had to be refueled by other Victor bombers so that they could carry the fuel far enough to refuel the Vulcan bombers when they got to a very advanced range. And so there was a very complicated series of refuelings taking place in order to get the Vulcan bombers over the Falkland Islands. And the very first attack, when these are called Black Buck raids, the very first attack by a Vulcan bomber on the Falklands was carried out by just a single bomber. And these Vulcan bombers carried around about 20,000-pound bombs. And this single bomber made it to the Falklands Islands and dropped its bombs, only one of which landed on the runway, which was the target. The others all missed, but that obviously landed around the airfield in various places and probably did a fair bit of destruction anyway. But the one bomb landing on the runway was sufficient to then mean that the Argentinian Air Force couldn't land fighter planes and bombers on the island, which meant that all of the aircraft used by the Argentinians had to be flown from mainland Argentina over to the Falkland Islands. And of course, by the time they got there, they were almost out of fuel or running low on fuel and would only have a very brief period of being able to, you know, they would have to drop their bomb on the first thing that they saw that was related to the British military. Instead of choosing a target of choice, they were just going in there and just wildly dropping bombs at the first target that they saw, because they had to turn around and fly back again before they ran out of fuel getting back to the Argentinian mainland. So those raids by the Vulcan bombers were of massive importance to the success of the whole venture.
Absolutely essential. Let me just ask there, Max. You're saying that it was just one bomb that actually hit the airstrip, and that was all that was needed. So was it just one aircraft? I mean, did it sort of stealthily fly there? Were the Argentinians aware that it was coming, or was it like a fleet of aircraft? Because I can imagine that it would have been done quite stealthily, with just one plane and then the other ones going along with it to refuel as it went along the way. Or was it a whole fleet of aircraft that went there? Do you know?
It would have been one Vulcan bomber took off from Ascension Island, would have flown 2,000 miles. And when it had gone 2,000 miles, one of the Victor aircraft that would have flown 2,000 miles would have refueled it. The Victor aircraft would have then had to turn back to go back to the Falklands. Another Victor refueling aircraft would have had to have taken off and would have flown the 2,000 miles. Two Victor aircraft would have flown the 2,000 miles. One of them would have then refueled the other Victor so that it could then fly another 2,000 miles to refuel the Vulcan when it was over the Falkland Islands. And then as the Vulcan flew back again, another Victor would have had to have refueled it halfway so that it could make its way back to Ascension Island. So there would have been four aircraft involved in getting that one Vulcan bomber over the Falklands so it could drop its payload on the on Stanley. And it was estimated that each raid of that sort consumed, and this will make you gasp at the sort of 1,100,000 gallons of aircraft fuel were consumed in each one of those raids. And there were six of them in total over the course of the Falklands War. And so it shows you what an immense undertaking, you know, that just the flying of the bomber out there to knock out the Stanley airfield was, let alone all of the rest of sending a flotilla of ships, because we had, as part of the British Task Force, we had a nuclear-powered submarine, the Conqueror. We had two aircraft carriers, the Invincible and the Hermes. We requisitioned the SS Canberra, which is an ocean liner, and the Queen Elizabeth II, which is an ocean liner, to ferry the troops down there. And in total had a task force consisting of 127 ships, 43 of them naval ships, 22 of them from the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, and 62 of them merchant ships. And so that was a massive undertaking. The one of the interesting aspects of all of this is that the sovereignty of the Falkland Islands had been disputed for quite some time. And in 1965, there was a United Nations resolution passed urging the Argentinian government and the UK government to reach an agreement about who was going to have sovereignty of the Falkland Islands in the long term. The islanders all wanted to remain part of Britain. And so they then petitioned politicians over here in the UK to represent them in Parliament. But the Foreign and Colonial Office, who've got their eye on economics and the expansion of international trade, they thought it would be better for Britain if we gave away the Falkland Islands in terms of developing trade with Argentina and other South American nations. And so they were campaigning in Parliament in order to get Parliament to give the Falkland Islands away. And the Tory politician, I'm not quite sure what his position was, he may have been Foreign Secretary, I'm not absolutely sure, but Nicholas Ridley was the individual who was involved in trying to sort of at one point persuade the inhabitants of the Falkland Islands to agree to a sort of sale and lease back arrangement, which would be the same kind of thing that we did with Hong Kong, where we would just be leasing the Falkland Islands for the foreseeable future, but they would then eventually return to the Argentina. They would then go to Argentina. But the Falkland Islands owners didn't want it, but in exasperation, Nicholas Ridley said in Parliament, and this is recorded in Hansard, if we don't do something, they'll invade and there's nothing we can do about it. And the point is that the Argentinian government obviously got that message and decided that that was almost like a sort of a green light for them to invade, thinking that our government would not do anything about it and, in fact, wouldn't be able to do anything about it. But that was wrong. Both Nicholas Ridley and the Argentinian government were completely wrong about that. But as far as the programme that's on the BBC is concerned, it's... as I say, it's called the Our Falklands War, the Frontline Story. It then tells the story of the troops that landed on the western island of the Falklands, which was that these troops were Royal Marine Commandos and also the two para, the parachute regiment, and they then managed to take the largest settlement in that part of the island, which is called San Carlos, fairly swiftly. But then they had to move south, and there was a very like a causeway between the part of the Falklands dominated by San Carlos and the main part of the Falkland Islands. And on this little causeway, at one end of the causeway, was the settlement called Goose Green. And the soldiers that are being interviewed for this program on BBC, they give an account of what happened in terms of the capture of Goose Green. But Goose Green was a military victory snatched from the jaws of defeat, because the Marines and the parachute regiment had fought valiantly, but had come under very heavy fire and had suffered quite a few casualties in terms of getting to Goose Green. And by the time they reached Goose Green, lots of them were suffering from trench foot, because the Falkland Islands are very wet and they'd had to wade ashore and get themselves thoroughly wet when they first arrived at the island. And the British troops were also very low on ammunition and in danger of running out of ammunition. But they did overrun a number of Argentinian soldiers that they then sat down, and these Argentinian soldiers could speak English. And so the commander of the British forces there wrote a note and a declaration of surrender, that he wanted the Argentinian commander of Goose Green to sign. And the effect that had on the Argentinians was that they just surrendered en masse. And so the 600 British troops that were involved in the Battle of Goose Green had fought themselves up all the way down this narrow causeway to the very edge of Goose Green, and then were amazed to see something like 1,000 to 1,200 or so Argentinian soldiers surrendering to them. And the Argentinians outnumbered them by something like 2-1. And so they were quite astounded by the fact that the Argentinians had surrendered in the way that they did. But then they were able to see then that a large proportion of the Argentinian soldiers were new conscripts who weren't very experienced and who were having a really lousy war. They didn't like the climate. They didn't like that they weren't battle hardened or anything of that sort. And many of them were just very terrified of, what was likely to happen to them. But then the story then progresses across the island to Bluff Cove, and then also to the battle for Stanley. But it's the moving aspect of the account given by the soldiers is that each one of them pretty well gives an account of the first occasion where they had to kill somebody, and the effect that it had on them, and the sort of lasting psychological effect that that's had on them ever since. I do know some people who fought on the Falklands, and that is the sort of, that I do know that they have suffered psychological problems as a result of the experience that they had, because war is a terrible thing and a terrible process. And But the BBC programme tells the whole story from a point of view in which the participants in that war can feel proud of what they achieved, but also that in such a way that the damaging effects of war and the lasting psychological effects of war can be understood, and so you can understand why some soldiers, when they come back from war, are sort of damaged in that respect to some extent, and that we should have be understanding of that.
So it's quite an incredible tale, really. I mean, they called their bluff there at the end and still managed to get victory. What it really shows is where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, overcoming all those difficulties, and the most important thing was to take out the runway and succeeding in doing that. I mean, it really is a tale of a battle against all odds. And I guess what the important thing about this program is that it shows you the psychological effect, as you say there, Max. I mean, we don't often hear about that and the terrible effects that war actually has on the people that are involved in it. I mean, that First World War, I mean, the effects of that afterwards were just so damaging, and we had no idea about post-traumatic stress or anything like that. And the people would come home from the war and they'd lose their temper, and people just wouldn't understand. And you think the horrific things that went on there, with people losing their arms, losing their legs. I mean, before that, it had been, you know, musket shot and swords, and suddenly it was high-tech weaponry and gas and tanks and all sorts. And now you've got, you've got horrific weapons now, haven't you? You've got drones which aren't even manned. You've got somebody just with a remote control set on a computer somewhere. So it's just completely separated from what's actually going on from the actual killing. Yet it is still killing. It's horrific, but it is it is great that we actually won that war. It is something that we can be proud of, fighting against them from all the way from over the other side of the world and finding ways to get over all these problems and surmounting them. And we have talked about this before in our series on Enoch Powell. Because he had some commentary to make on the war, and I think we did a half-hour section on the Falklands War, if listeners want to go and check that out in the Greatest Britain section. Do you want to add anything more to that, Max?
Just that one of the key aspects of that particular story is the sort of almost masterly the masterpiece of military logistics that was involved in, first of all, getting the bombers down there so they could knock out Stanley, the runway at Stanley, but also getting the troops down there as well. You know, it's something I think that British people can be proud of.
Justifiably proud of. Well, shall we move into our Greatest Britons then for today, Max?
Yep, let's do that.
Okay, we have another great Briton. I mean, we just have so many of these people from all different walks of life. And today's Greatest Briton is an archaeologist. And he's a particular favourite of mine because he really popularised Avebury and Stonehenge. And it seems up till that point, we really hadn't sort of looked at them and thought how important they are. And of course, we've just had the recent Jubilee and the Queen's face was projected on Stonehenge, and people travel from all over the world now to come to Stonehenge for the solstice, and also Avebury Stone Circle as well, which is nearby to Stonehenge. And I think it was written about by Geoffrey of Monmouth, and he claimed that Merlin the Magician had gone to Ireland and magicked the stones over to Britain. And I think that's just about the only reference that we actually have to Stonehenge up until this point and up until this man. His name was William Stukeley, born 7th of November 1687, and he died the 3rd of March 1765. He was an English antiquarian, a physician, and an Anglican clergyman. A significant influence on the later development of archaeology, he pioneered the scholarly investigation of the prehistoric monuments of Stonehenge and Avebury in Wiltshire. He published over 20 books on archaeology and other subjects during his lifetime. From 1710 until 1725, he embarked on annual tours of the countryside, seeking out archaeological monuments and other features that interested him. He wrote up and published several accounts of his travels. In 1717, he returned to London and established himself within the city's antiquarian circles. In 1718, he was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society, and he became the first secretary of the Society of Antiquaries of London. In 1721, he became a Freemason, and in 1722, he co-founded the Society of Roman Knights, an organisation devoted to the study of Roman Britain. In the early 1720s, Stukeley developed a particular interest in Stonehenge and Avebury, two prehistoric circles in Wiltshire, and he visited them repeatedly, undertaking fieldwork to determine their dimensions. He was a friend of the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Wake, who encouraged him to use his antiquarian studies to combat the growth of deism and free thought in Britain. And deism is the philosophical position and rationalistic theology that generally rejects revelation as a source of divine knowledge and asserts that empirical reason and observation of the natural world are exclusively logical, reliable, and sufficient to determine the existence of a supreme being as the creator of the universe. And this really seems to me to sort of contradict itself, to say that to reject revelation as a source of divine knowledge. I mean, that's the definition of it being divine, is that it comes by revelation. It's like the Greeks had philosophy, which was basically discussing the world and looking at it and coming to God that way. And then you had the Hebrews that had revelation that included prophecy, and it was the prophecy of what was going to happen in the future that gave this this understanding of history and actually things progressing from one point in time to another. And the two came together with Christianity. It married the Greek philosophy with the Hebrew prophecy. So what deism was rejecting half of that, rejecting this divine knowledge. So he was against that. And free thought is an epistemological viewpoint which holds that beliefs should not be formed on the basis of authority, tradition, revelation, or dogma, and that beliefs should instead be reached by other methods such as logic, reason, and empirical observation. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, a free thinker is a person who forms their own ideas and opinions rather than accepting those of other people, especially in religious teaching. So again, what it was saying here is like, oh, you should ignore authority, you should ignore tradition. And Stukeley's ideas came from traditions and looking at the traditions. And I mean, we should observe the traditions of our elders and our ancestors, and we should include their religious beliefs, and we should also use logic, reason, and empirical observation. You know, the one shouldn't exclude the other. And I think that's what Stukeley was wanting to say. I don't think he was you know, saying we shouldn't use logic and reason, because he was great friends with Isaac Newton. He was one of the first people to write a biography of Isaac Newton, and so he understood, you know, science. And he was a physician himself, and he used to do autopsies. So I think really he wasn't against free thought or against deism, but wanted that to be married with empirical tradition. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Max, at all.
A lot of what you've gone through there is very deep, actually, and it's difficult to sort of respond to without being able to give it a considerable amount of thought. But what I would say is that quite often when people start to learn about science and about cosmology and the existence of the universe, etc., they quite often turn away from traditional religious beliefs, thinking that the idea of there being anything that's supernatural is contrary to what they're learning, which ostensibly it is. But then once you start to examine things that the absolutes as far as science is concerned, then you inevitably arrive at a point where there is no rational explanation of something, because our knowledge in that area is just not sufficient to give us a logical explanation. And so therefore you then are then stepping into the realms of the supernatural. And so, for example, if you look at the Big Bang theory, People say, oh, well, you know, there was this big bang and all the sort of energy and matter of, in the universe came rushing out for a central point. But then you ask the question, you know, what existed prior to the big bang then? What created the big bang and the rush of energy that came out of it? And then you're left in a situation where nobody knows. And it's the sort of the route to madness trying to decide what it was that existed beforehand, because no remains, as far as we're aware, nothing remains of whatever existed prior to the Big Bang. You know, the Big Bang would appear to have taken place, but what existed prior to the Big Bang, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest one way or the other what did exist prior to that. And so you've only got fantasy or ignorance, really, to sort of resort to in terms of trying to decide what did happen beforehand. And again, if you look at things like the existence of the Higgs boson, the fact that it was called the God particle, again, sort of indicates that scientists reach a certain point in their understanding of the nature of matter beyond which they can't go, because our knowledge just doesn't extend beyond there. And so therefore it is pretty much guesswork as to, you know, what exists beyond that.
Yeah, I think people get to that point as well, and they see the interconnectedness of it all and the complexity of it all, and that gives them an understanding that, you know, it couldn't have all just happened by chance, basically. So it's really the sort of the marrying the two together. But at this time there was this big big push towards this free thinking and deism, and Stigley was against that, and he was encouraged to be against that by his friend the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he suggested that he should use his antiquarian studies to combat this. To this end, Stukeley developed the belief that Britain's ancient Druids had followed a monotheistic religion inherited from the biblical patriarchs. And he called this Druidic religion patriarchal Christianity. And of course, I'm taking my notes here from Wikipedia, but I don't think Stukeley would have said that that was what he was doing. I think Stukeley would have said, well, I'm looking at what they say about the Druids in antiquity, and I've noticed that there are links with that to what the Hebrew priests were following. And also we have quotes that from Taliesin the Bard from about the 6th or the 7th century, which says that Druidry was very similar to Christianity. So I think he was looking at these records, and that was where he was getting it from. They sort of imply here that he came up with this idea because he wanted to dissuade people from following deism and free thinking. But I think it was more that this was just a logical path that he ended up on from his studies. He further argued that the Druids had erected the stone circles as part of serpentine monuments symbolising the Trinity. In 1747, he returned to London as the rector of St. George the Marcher, Holborn, and in the last part of his life, he became instrumental in British scholarship's acceptance of Charles Bertram's forged description of Britain, and this actually led to him falling out of favour a bit. But he also wrote one of the earliest biographies of his friend Isaac Newton. Stukeley's ideas influenced various antiquaries throughout the 18th and early 19th centuries, in addition to artists like William Blake, although had been largely rejected by archaeologists by the second half of the 19th century. He is nevertheless regarded as an important forerunner of archaeology for his emphasis on methodically measuring and documenting ancient sites. He has since become the subject of multiple biographies and academic studies by scholars like Stuart Pigott, David Boyd Haycock, and Ronald Hutton. So he was measuring these sites and recording them and documenting them. And this is why it's so important that he did this, because so many of them have fallen down since then, and people were using them as building materials. So we can look at the pictures that he drew in the 16th century, and we can get more of an idea of what Avebury looked like before the road was put through it, for instance. And also this shows that, I mean, he wasn't engaging in spiritualism or trying to contact the people from the past to get his information. He was measuring the circles, and he was looking at what people had to say throughout the past. And this bit about the Trinity as well, I mean, we find the number three in an a lot of religions. In Egyptology, we find it in Hinduism, and a lot of people say that it was there in Druidry, and particularly Stukely. And there is a belief that that may be where the Trinity comes from in Christianity, is from the Trinity that was there actually in Druidism. So he was really the first to put all this stuff together and direct people's attention to Stonehenge and Avebury. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Well, just to say that in terms of the him measuring the and recording where the stones are, I find Avebury to be a very attractive place to go and visit. It's a great day out, actually, if anybody wants to find a place that's it is to some extent spiritually uplifting, but at the same time it gives you a fair bit of exercise as well. I first encountered Avebury when I was traveling back. In fact, it was when I'd been on a very long motorcycle ride down to the West Country, and I was on my way back, and it was absolutely lashing down with rain, and I was absolutely cold and wet, and just wanted to get home. But I just suddenly realized, as I was riding along this what appeared to be just like a lane, that there was this massive standing stone. In fact, not just one standing stone, but a line of standing stones that ran along the edge of the road and then crossed over the road and continued on the other side. And I was astounded by that. And so when I got back and I dried off, I then went online and then discovered that I'd actually ridden through Avebury without actually realizing it. But and so I then went back to see what was there. And yes, it is a very large stone circle. There are lots of the stones that are now erect. And I believe that there was a chap during the it probably was sometime during the 18th century or something of that sort, who went around buying up properties in Avebury because he identified the fact that the standing stones had been buried in people's gardens. They'd been pushed over by the over the years, and people had just built their houses on top of them. So he was knocking the houses down and re-erecting the stones, and that caused a bit of controversy with the local people, who didn't like having their village reduced in size by somebody who was trying to preserve these artifacts from the past. But the Avebury certainly is a great place to go and visit.
It's a huge megalithic complex. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a huge megalithic complex. You got Silbury Hill there. You got West Kennet, Longbarrow. I mean, it's obviously very, very important to our people in the past. I think Silbury Hill is the largest man-made monument, largest man-made hill in Europe. I mean, it's huge.
I think it is, and it's entirely made of chalk. It's roughly a mile or two south of Avebury itself, but it's you can't miss it because it is this conical shaped hill covered in grass. But it is composed entirely of chalk. And when it was first discovered, people thought that it was a burial mound. But archaeologists have burrowed in right to the very bottom of it and burrowed down through the top of it, trying to find a burial chamber. But there isn't a burial chamber. It is just a massive mound of chalk that's slightly flattened on the top. And then also just a couple of miles south of Silbury Hill, there is West Kennet Longbarrow, as you say. West Kennet Longbarrow is probably the oldest building on mainland Britain. There is a similar thing which is at a place in Northern Ireland, just south of the Irish border, which the name of which I can't quite remember.
Newgrange. Is it Newgrange?
Newgrange, that's it, that's the one. So with Newgrange is constructed in such a way that the at certain times of the day, I think the winter and summer solstices, the light shines down through a space between two pillars and shines onto an altar that's underground. But West Kennet Longbarrow would have been created at around about the same kind of time. But this was a series of burial chambers where over a period of centuries, people that died would eventually would have their bodies stored there until they rotted away and it was just became a skeleton. And then the various parts of the skeleton were then put in the other chambers. But you can go inside West Kennet Long Barrow. It isn't locked or shut or anything of that sort. So any time, day or night, that you go to West Kennet Long Barrow, you can walk inside. It will be dark if it's because there's no lighting, obviously. But if you go there with a torch, you can go in and explore it. And so, but Silbury Hill itself, if you were to travel to the top of Silbury Hill, what you would find as you looked around is that the countryside around it forms a natural amphitheatre. And so in the absence of any other explanation as to what Silbury Hill is, my theory on it is that Silbury Hill was a platform at the top of which religious ceremonies would have taken place so that thousands of people could gather and camp out on the natural amphitheatre around it, and they would be able to see the religious ceremony taking place at the top of Silbury Hill. I can't think of any other logical reason for it, because it's been estimated that it would have taken, I can't think what it was now, 500 men, something like 50 years to shift the amount of chalk needed and to pile it up in order to create Silbury Hill. So, you know, why would 1,000 men labour for 50 years in order to create something that was just going to be a big pile of chalk, basically? It must have had a purpose.
Yeah, it's like the amount of time it would have taken to do that is similar to the amount of time it would take us, you know, 500-600 years ago to build a cathedral. Take 100-120 years. And you've got all this chalk that was built there. And then you've also got these huge, great sarsen stones, these great chunks of granite and rock. I mean, I saw one the other day, and it was 40 tons, a capstone, 40 tons capstone. I'm not sure how big the capstone is at West Kennet Long Barrow, but I mean, it's just an incredible achievement that these places were built. And you think, you know, nobody really noticed this or thought, well, this is really interesting. We should be writing about this. There was somebody before Stukeley, a guy called Aubrey, and the Aubrey holes at Stonehenge at Woodhenge, they were named after him. But it was really Stukeley that popularized this and went out drawing attention to these. I mean, Avebury is it's an incredible complex, something to be really proud of in Britain. And Stukeley was the guy that really popularized this, and this is why I say he's one of our greatest Britons, because he really noticed this, drew attention to it, and then tried to work out who it was that built these things, why they built them, and he was quite a celebrity of his time, and he's still referenced today by people that are interested in these things. Well, getting back to our notes here, from 1710 until 1725, Stukeley embarked on a horseback expedition through the countryside at least once a year, taking notes on the things that he observed. In 1710, for example, he first visited the prehistoric ceremonial complex, the Rollright Stones. At the time, his interests were not purely antiquarian, for he also took notes on landscape gardens and other more recent constructions that he encountered. And this reminds me of the people today that go out in their caravans all around Britain. Back then, people would go out on horseback, and they would just look around the country. Stukeley befriended the antiquary Morris Johnson and joined Johnson's learned society, the Spalding Gentlemen's Society, which is still based in Spalding, Lincolnshire. A 1714 letter indicates that Johnson recommended several books on British history to Stukeley, apparently at the latter's request. The suggested titles include Julius Caesar's De Bello Gallico, John Milton's The History of Britain, Robert Brady's An Introduction to the Old English History, Peter Halen's Help to English History, and Richard Rowland's A Restitution of Decayed Intelligence in Antiquities Concerning the Most Noble and Renowned English Nation. Another letter to Johnson, this time from May 1714, reveals that Stukeley was assembling a series of chronological tables of all the British kings since Brutus of Troy, following the medieval historian Geoffrey of Monmouth, who we have also done included in our Greatest Britain series. It says here, Stukeley believed that the legendary Brutus was a real historical figure. Well, everybody did at that time. And there's lots of evidence to show that he was a real historical figure. I mean, it was mentioned by Nennius. It wasn't first mentioned by Geoffrey of Monmouth. This was the accepted history of Britain. In September 1716, he wrote an account of Richborough Castle, a Roman-Saxon shore fort in Kent. That same year, he described having made a model of the Neolithic Bronze Age stone circle of Stonehenge. So we can see here that he's been travelling around the countryside on horseback. He's got interested in these megalithic sites and these old complexes, and now he's getting interested in the history itself. And up until this point, I mean, he's basically been a doctor. I mean, I forgot to say much about his childhood, but he came from a fairly wealthy family. He did very well at school, but he was taken out of school at the age of 13 to help out with the legal profession, because his father was part of a legal profession. And then after that, he got involved in a medical career, and he was famous for dissecting somebody that had been hanged and basically dissecting things. So he also understood was trying to understand how things work and the importance of taking things apart, which helped him with his antiquarianism and his archaeology. So he's basically starting to get interested in our history. And we can also see here, you know, how we used to look upon ourselves with the title of this book, The Most Renowned English Nation. You know, we didn't used to think of ourselves as terrible people. You know, we were quite proud of ourselves. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that Stukeley is another of the polymaths that existed in quite large numbers at that time. And I know people who, on an amateur basis, develop a vast amount of and probably encyclopedic knowledge of all sorts of different things. So he studied medicine, he studied the law, he also studied antiquarianism, and so just like other polymaths that we've spoken about before, you know, he's an outstanding character and an outstanding member of our nation.
Yeah, that's a good point that you bring up there as well, because he survived childhood, and if you survived childhood, then you must have had very good genes, and if you have very good genes, the chances are you're going to have a high IQ. So, and I guess that might explain why there were so many of these polymaths about, because it does seem that we had a lot of people like that in our past, less so today. Well, Stukeley devoted much attention to Avebury during the 1720s. The records he produced of how the monument and its various features looked at the time has been important for later archaeologists, for by the early 20th century, when the earliest sustained archaeological investigation of the site took place, many of these features had been lost. He witnessed locals breaking up megaliths in the circle, and although powerless to stop them, it may have been this observation that led him to produce a detailed record of the site. And he also took records of other sites and encouraged people to measure them, and that led on to Professor Tom, who measured them, I think, in the 50s and the 60s, and worked out this megalithic inch and this megalithic yard, and they're all actually built to a specific unit of measurement, which shows that we had universal measures at that time, rulers and what have you, and it's also linked to the pyramid inch and the pyramid yard in the Great Pyramid. Well, it was while at Avebury in 1723 that he began a draft of the history of the temples of the ancient Celts. This work drew upon his fieldwork at both Avebury and Stonehenge, as well as his field notes from other prehistoric sites and information obtained from the Templar Druidum section of Aubrey's Monumenta Britannica. The work also cited biblical and classical texts. In the book, Stukeley discussed how prehistoric people might have erected such monuments using sledges, timber cradles, rollers, and levers. He devoted much space to refuting the suggestion made by Inigo Jones and Jay Webb that Stonehenge had been erected by the Romans, instead attributing it to the prehistoric, or as he called it, Celtic period. The Druids are mentioned only briefly in the book, when Stukeley suggested that they might be possible creators of the stone circles. So you see here, he's citing classical texts, he's also citing biblical texts. So this is where his ideas came from, that the Druids were connected to the Bible and that they were the ones that built this. It came from looking at these texts. It wasn't because he was trying to get people to ignore deism and free thinking, I think. I think it was logical that he came to these conclusions. In 1740, he published Stonehenge, a book that he described as being devoted to the subject of patriarchal Christianity. He believed that learned people would read the book to learn about stone circles and druids, and that in doing so they would encounter the ancient proto-Christian of Christianity of Britain, and thus recognize how similar it was to modern Anglicanism. In doing so, he believed they would reject the ideas promoted by deism and the free thinkers. And the Church of England was, you know, really important to them at the time. They just had the Reformation, and our history, our British history, says that we actually had Christianity in Britain before it had even taken off in Rome. And this sort of led to this understanding that perhaps the British Church actually preceded Roman Catholicism, and therefore Anglicanism or the British Church was the correct one, rather than Roman Catholicism. So there was all these thoughts going on at the time, and he was linking it in with Druidry and linking it in with these stone circles. Another interesting point, actually, in the Old Testament, there's at least a dozen verses talking about erecting standing stones, stone circles, and dolmens. It actually talks about building these things in the Old Testament. So I think that probably led him to draw these connections there as well. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
I'd say that various ancient religions do feed off of each other, because the peoples that founded religions didn't exist in a vacuum. They had borders where they would meet other people of different beliefs, and so various ideas would get passed from one to the other. And so I think that that is often a cause of similarities that exist between religions.
Well, that's a good point. It's a good point. I think also, various white people have had different religions at different times, and you can see elements of them weaved into all of them. I mean, still today, you can see elements of our pre-Christian beliefs that are woven into traditional Christianity. If you look at some of the angels and the saints, they're named after older spiritual figures. If you look at Odin, you can see similarities there with the tradition that we have of Father Christmas today.
Celebration of evergreen plants, fir trees and the holly and things of that sort at Christmas time.
All of it is linked in together with pre-Christian beliefs. Well, next up we have his ideas, but I think maybe we will leave that for next week, Max, unless you've got anything else you want to add, any other thoughts on Stonehenge or Avebury or Stukeley before we finish?
Just that Avebury is a great place to go and visit. As I said earlier on, it is a good day out. There is a pub in the middle of Avebury village called the Red Lion, which is reputed to be the most haunted pub in England. Whether that's true or not, I'll leave entirely up to you and your own religious beliefs. But the history of the Red Lion pub is that that one of the owners of the pub, perhaps centuries ago, killed his wife and threw her down a well. And if you go into one of the main bar of the pub, there is the well has been preserved with a glass top to it, so you can sort of walk over it and look down, and they've got a light at the bottom so you can see the place where this woman's body, apparently, or a skeleton, was eventually found. And so at least one person was killed at the Red Lion pub, one must suppose. They do a cracking beef and ale pie there, if that's the sort of thing that you like to eat. And so it's well worth going there for a visit, having a look at these ancient monuments, but also having a nice pub lunch as well.
Yeah, there's one other point we should make there as well. Unlike in Stonehenge, which has like a rope fence around it, and the only time you can actually get in close to the stones is at the solstices, at Avebury you can get up close to the stones whenever you go there. You can walk through them and have a look at them, sit down. There's one that's like a throne there, like a chair, and you can walk all around it and go into West Kennet Long Barrow. It's not like you can only look and not touch, as it were. So yeah, I would definitely recommend that people go and check out Avebury and all our megalithic sites. They're all part of our fantastic heritage that we have as the British people. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.